Welcome to the Experiencing Financial Contentment podcast. In this monthly digest, I cover the main ideas and talking points, the Cliff Notes version, if you will, from the previous month's releases on my YouTube channel. Please visit www.youtube.com/theyoutubecfp to find these and any other videos on the topics of financial literacy, economic empowerment, and personal development. Thanks for listening and enjoy this episode. What is up, everybody? This is Dominique Henderson with DJH Capital Management, helping you to do more with your life and money. And we are bringing to you today the monthly podcast summary for June. And let me just say, I hope that you have a great Independence Day coming up when you receive this episode or as you're listening to it. I'm recording it right before the week of the 4th, where we celebrate independence here in this country. So hopefully you will spend that doing some things that are productive and celebrating the freedom that you have. This month's summary for all of you that are listening new is a summary, audio summary of all the topics that we covered this past month on the YouTube channel. And we started this a couple months ago and it's going really great. I enjoy doing it. And so you get the Cliff Notes version of everything we talked about on the YouTube channel, which does not preclude you from checking out the videos and some of the illustrations that we do. You never know when we'll have a special guest, but please subscribe for a more detailed version. You can just click, you can go to the YouTube channel, which is youtube.com/theyoutubecfp, and you can hit the subscribe button in that little bell notification. That way, when we release new episodes on the channel, you will get those as soon as we drop them. And so we got weekly downloads for you on the YouTube channel and a monthly podcast summary in audio form, so that if you're heading back and forth to work or you're doing whatever you're doing, you can just, you know, subscribe on your podcast catcher of choice, whether that be iTunes or Stitcher or any of the other ones. So don't want to keep you waiting. Let's jump right into week one. In week one, we talked about how to build wealth. And my goal was really to provide you with the simplest formula for understanding how much you're worth, right? Assets minus liabilities equals your net worth. And wanted to give you a couple steps to increase that number, a couple of tips. Just as a backdrop, every once in a while I do these talks, and this episode was actually on the back of a conversation I had with a group of individuals here in Dallas. We talked about really personal finance in at large, but you know, we covered topics like credit and taxes and retirement savings and whatnot. And I think at the heart of all those different, what I would call satellite topics, there is one core belief or value or let's call it true north that you need to have, and that is understanding your net worth. I also had just noticed, if you are a fan of hip hop or just in the news, you noticed that not too long ago, Jay-Z cracked the Forbes list as a billionaire. And so I had done an Instagram post about this, and we had this podcast episode. And I was thinking about, you know, okay, so Jay-Z's cracked his, you know, billion-dollar mark. What are you doing to get to the number that you want to be, right? And that that common denominator, the smallest common denominator there, is understanding your net worth. How much do you owe versus how much do you own, right? You want the own part, the O-W-N, to be greater than the O-W-E, right? And eventually I would say having the O-W-E part, what you owe, the liabilities, the debts and things of that, eventually be approaching zero. So often the smallest thing, like not knowing how to calculate how much your net worth is, will derail any plans that you have to accumulate more wealth. Like, how could you know the formula for being wealthy, which is, you know, by definition, at least my definition, is having options. I think Chris Rock said that first. Give credit where credit is due. But having options and building wealth, you got to understand the formula that goes into that, right? So I've talked about this before, but you as a human, you go out into the world with your skill set, your human capital. You exchange your human capital, usually in the form of giving your skills and your time to someone that is going to pay you for that, and they return to you financial capital, usually in the form of money. That money is then designed for you to go build wealth with, right? So you go put it in stocks and bonds and different asset classes. You buy a home that appreciates, yada, yada, yada. You build up your asset pool so that you can continue to grow your net worth and thereby your wealth. So your human capital is a direct correlation to your wealth. So you have to understand how you can convert first that human capital into financial capital to then invest it and then grow your net worth. So I would say, by and large, if you find yourself in a loop of I have more month than money, or you're, you know, living paycheck to paycheck, you need to evaluate your habits. It follows that you shouldn't be surprised if you constantly find yourself in this cycle of having more month than money, that you have not taken that formula that I've just given you to heart. So the essence of that is understanding that assets minus liabilities equals your net worth, that you have to accumulate assets in excess of your liabilities in order to grow your wealth. You have to leverage that human capital, right? If you earn 50K a year, don't spend all 50K. You need to be somewhere between spending about 30 to 35K in order to build some momentum. And then invest that difference. Of course, the part that you don't pay the taxes, but invest that difference into assets that will grow over time. And then finally, reduce the amount of debt, specifically bad debt that you accumulate. And I would say the definition of a bad debt is any asset that will never be worth more than what you used to, than what you paid for it, right? So you buy a car for 25 grand, you drive it off the lot, it's immediately worth less than that and will never ever be worth 25 grand. That's not to say you won't get 25 grand of utility out of it. It's just to say that you can probably buy other cars that will give you just as much utility and just as much mileage rather than a car that is way outside of your budget that causes you to grow your wealth and your net worth slower. So you just want to be cognizant of that. Hey there, this is Dominique. And if you're enjoying this executive summary, you're going to want to subscribe to my YouTube channel. There is so much more that I cover on a weekly basis inside the videos, and I would love for you to be a part of the community. So here's what you need to do. Just navigate to www.youtube.com/theYouTubeCFP to subscribe to the channel and make sure you hit that bell notification so that you can get updates as soon as we release them. Now back to the monthly podcast digest. In evaluating portfolio performance, how to evaluate your portfolio. This is always a fun topic for me because as a financial planner and as someone that has spent at this point, 2 decades as a student of the financial markets, I get into a lot of interesting conversations. And I won't give away the little cute anecdote that I had on the YouTube channel for this particular episode. You need to go back to that episode, Evaluating Portfolio Performance, How to Evaluate Your Portfolio. And I insert a little story that I had with a prospective client once. But nonetheless, I think investors should really be focused on other ways to measure their portfolio's performance. So here's another story that is going to be unique. Is you get a first on listening to this audio version. So I don't give away everything on the YouTube channel. I reserve a little bit for my listening audience only. So here you go, guys. So I'm at this conference a couple weeks ago in June, middle June. And, you know, we're talking, it's a conference designed for industry professionals. So, you know, everybody sitting next to me are CFAs and CFPs and financial professionals. And, you know, we're talking about portfolio performance and we're talking about all these things. And, you know, I'm sitting there thinking, you know, what is the real value in measuring your portfolio against a arbitrary benchmark like the S&P? Right. For instance, so, you know, the market returns whatever, you know, it's up 1% for the day or down 5% or whatever. And a lot of people get in angst about their portfolio and say, what do I need to change? What do I need to switch? Not everybody, but a lot of people do. And my point is, or my question is, why? what is the point there? What are you really comparing yourself to? Like, this is obviously, you know, in the case of the S&P, it's only a portion of, you know, let's say the 4,000 securities or so that are in the U.S. It's only 500 of the largest. So granted, it's a sizable sample size from a statistical standpoint. But at the end of the day, who invests 100% in equities? Who invests in the companies that are in the S&P without changing those? And so I think when you just kind of step back a minute and think about how the media and or popular news has conditioned the average investor to think about evaluating their portfolio, it's really kind of nonsense if you think about it. So I think my main concern is that investors too often assume that the Dow Jones or the S&P are the correct measures. But like I said, those are 100% equities. What about a 60-40 portfolio, for instance, where you have a fair amount of fixed income in there to balance out and or cause less volatility in your portfolio? That's the purpose of the fixed income instruments, because they're negatively correlated in most markets. They have, in most market cycles they've been. So I guess the point here is there might be a case of that, but generally speaking, when you lose 40% in 1 year, i.e. 2008, and you have to make 67% to get back to even, that's a problem. Most people, you know, and we'll talk about that math in a different episode, but the point is, you know, nobody's going to go 100% in equity. So why then would you be comparing your portfolio to the S&P? That's why, you know, measures such as risk tolerance questionnaires and things of that nature that measure not only your ability to handle risk, which is, you know, really quantified on your balance sheet and in your checking account, but your willingness to handle it, which is more of a cognitive measure, right? A cognitive and an emotional bias measure to say, what is your appetite for risk in context of what is your money story? How do you view money and what are you trying to get your money to do? And there are better measures for that than just comparing your portfolio to the S&P. So that's what we talked about in that particular episode. I give you two right now. So the first is a standard deviation, volatility, right? How much up and down it goes. So you really want to kind of control, you know, the amount of risk you take. And the second one would be the Sharpe ratio. So the amount of risk you take in relation to how much return you get. And people always refer to these, at least in my industry, as the risk adjusted return. So you always want to say, so my portfolio went up 40%, but at the same time, it was, you know, it had 50% volatility. So nobody wants to really be in a portfolio like that, because you have the chance of being, you know, up 40 or down 10. that's a big difference. You want a portfolio ideally with a level of risk or volatility that you can handle, right? So let's just use real simple numbers here. Let's say that the average return on a portfolio is 10%. Well, that portfolio that has a standard deviation of, let's say, 10% also means that in any given year, that portfolio can be up plus or minus 10 from the average, right? So we can get up 20, we can get, you know, zero in this particular case. So I think people need to be more aware of that particular measure, because they're always, and I'm guilty of this too. You know, you look at how portfolios have done and how indices has done, and you look at the historical performance to say, oh, you know, this is going to possibly do this again, even though most disclaimers say that past performance is no guarantee of, you know, how the portfolio or the indices that you're looking at will perform in the future. Nevertheless, I just think that the better metric that you should center around when you're judging whether or not your portfolio has done well and you're doing this evaluation of performance, you need to include in a more diverse, broader measure, which includes risk, right? Because at the end of the day, there is no free lunch. If you want to take a lot of, if you want to have a lot of return in your portfolio, you need to have a lot of risk in your portfolio. And if you want to have low return in your portfolio, then you can take less risk. That's generally how that works. So that's what we talked about in evaluating portfolio performance, how to evaluate your portfolio. I really hope you're enjoying this executive summary. And if so, I want to hear from you. You can send me your comments from the same location that you downloaded this episode. Or if you want bonus points, you can email me at info@djh-capital.com. That is info@djh-capital.com. And let me know what kind of topics you'd like for me to cover in future episodes. Look, my goal is to see you do more with your life and money, okay? Now let's get back to the podcast. In how much does the average American make or spend? I found myself on Twitter, which I don't often do. It seems like I may be all around the social media universe, but I really hang out on just really a couple platforms. But that being said, every once in a while I am trolling around, not necessarily trolling, maybe strolling along the Twitter highway, and I find something that gets me to thinking. And I came across a article that an editor in the New York Times, Tim Herrera, he kind of tore into this this USA Today article about personal finance, and I was intrigued by the amount of comments and just, you know, thoughts and opinions about that particular thing. And it got me to thinking, like, what does it really matter that my neighbor spends X or Y, right? I spend, you know, let's say $100,000 a year for my lifestyle, and they spend 2X that, or, you know, 50% less than that. Does it really matter? And I think the notion around this is, as humans, we do like to compare ourselves to others, to, you know, really to kind of jockey on where we should be on the spectrum of what is the ideal life or what is the picture of success. Now, this is, I'm not going to go down this behavioral finance and behavioral economics and psychology train that you think I'm about to go down, because I think everybody has to find their own true north here. But I think, how much does the average American make and spend? I really had to just kind of reject the notion that what my neighbor does largely affects me. Now, especially from a financial standpoint, how they're running their budget has really nothing to do with me. At the end of the day, my lifetime earnings, so from all the wages I will bring in my lifetime and the earnings on those wages minus how much I spend on those, should be a positive number. That's all I really care about, right? If it's a negative number, that's a problem, obviously. I will have no means by which to probably finance my current lifestyle, my future lifestyle, or leave anything for my heirs. So that should be my primary concern. So what I wanted to really bring up here is, concentrate on your lifetime income. What do you think your earning capacity is? And then adjust your lifestyle to that so that you're able to save enough that allows you to have a positive number at the end of your days. That's all that matters. Don't worry about what the Joneses are doing and the cars they're buying and the house they're living in and all this other kind of stuff. I think it just really does not matter. And you want to be able to, I call it social indifference. Because, again, I was taught a long time ago, what other people think about you is none of your business. And I think that really applies in finances. If we did more as individuals to bolster and increase our own financial education and financial literacy for our own situations, we would be a whole lot better off. Often the comparison of other people to keep up with them in whatever capacity that looks like, whether that's a style or lifestyle or a job or whatever, tends to make us make irrational decisions. So I'm not speaking out of the side of my face right now. This has been documented in several books that, you know, talk about human behavior in relation to economics and how you know, spending choices and things of that nature, specifically around finance and money, are influenced more by irrational behavior than rational behavior. So just something to think about, because if you are worried about what the right number for you to spend is, I'm going to tell you right now, it's the number that allows you to live a lifestyle where you have a positive net worth. That's the number. Thanks for taking the time with me today to listen. Just one quick question before we continue. Have you subscribed to my YouTube channel yet? If you haven't, I want to give you just one more reason to subscribe, and that is every week I'll provide you with the very best tools from over 20 years in the industry to take control of your finances and reach your goals faster. How's that? Let's get back to the podcast for the final segment. In the Entrepreneur Wife Life 3 Valuable Takeaways, it was the absolute highlight of the month for me to have my boo, my queen, my honey of 22 years plus now on the podcast to talk through some of the lessons that she's learned, that we've learned living together in this, my third year in business on my own. And so really just got to share back and forth some of her takeaways as a wife, as one that knows me probably the most intimately and knows how I think, how I act, and, you know, kind of giving a perspective or a behind the scenes on my thought processes and some of the, you know, I would say more salient lessons of entrepreneurial life. And the idea was to provide some insight, right, to what it's like to be in relationship with the entrepreneur. You know, I talk to a lot of people that, you know, from a mentor to mentee standpoint about how to start a business and when to do it and, you know, all the different things. And I would say some of the takeaways, just as I may interject before I get to the gist of what we talked about on that podcast episode, is, you know, you've got to have some type of skill set. And, you know, I actually had a conversation yesterday with one of my college professors about, you know, school is good. Education is fine. And I'm not going to disparage education. What I will say, though, is largely that, you know, in my particular case and in a lot of different cases, that, you know, what you go to school to learn, let's say you go to school to be, whatever, the likelihood that you come out of school and get hired on a job for that exact same skill set you trained for or learned about is low, especially in today's economy. I think the most important thing about college education or higher education right now is getting in an environment that stretches you, that teaches you to think, because largely that's what I did. I mean, I went through so many different facets of a job types in finance, in my finance career, and now I'm running my own business as a financial planner. But that's not what I went to school to study. I studied finance and economics. And so and I learned about marketing and I learned about accounting, all of which things are great skill sets and foundationals, but things have changed. So you still have to kind of read. You have to, you know, go across disciplines. So all that to say, the entrepreneurial life, as my wife articulated in the podcast, is not the easiest to deal with. And that's because things change, right? The person that you are on someone's job, earning a paycheck, being, let's say, relegated or at least held accountable to pushing forward their vision and their profit motive and their mission and values. Of course, they need to be in alignment with yours. You can't be doing anything out of alignment, like stealing people's money or anything. But at the same time, your energy and your concentration goes there. Versus when you're an entrepreneur, you get to form those things. And so the cycle of how you evolve to what you're going to stand for and what your brand values are and what your mission and what your values are, or I'm sorry, vision is, that is a process. And so my wife talked about that and she said, you know, frankly, it's not the easiest to deal with. There's change. You know, I know I've worked very, very long hours and continue to do so. And we don't always know that beforehand, but like she said, the three takeaways she's learned, and hopefully this helps somebody out there, is you as the partner of the entrepreneur need to be secure in who you are as a person. You can't be looking for validation and or you can't be really codependent. It's hard because a lot of my mental energy in our particular situation is wrapped up in trying to move my business forward and get to a level that makes me happy and accomplishes my goals. And so that energy can't also be focused in on trying to, provide my wife with these things that she should already be having in herself is what she talked about. You also got to be flexible, right? Be able to accept change as it comes, because it will come. It won't be static. It'll be very dynamic. And then lastly, to be vocal, to speak your mind as a partner. And, you know, I really applaud her for that, because she doesn't bite her tongue and she is able to come to me at a way. And this is something we always kid about, is that I'm really good at listening to perspective. I will just about give anybody an ear on something. But whether I implement what you're talking about is something totally different. So we always talk about that, but she always has my ear. And generally speaking, I do what she says, because in most cases, and I'm not playing, she is smarter than me. So you got to be secure, you got to be flexible, and you got to be vocal. So that wraps up June's executive summary of our video podcast on the YouTube channel. Look, if you are listening and want to become a part of the tribe, the community of people that are trying to do more with their life and money, I'd love to connect with you. And here's how to do that. You can, of course, go to youtube.com/theYouTubeCFP, and you can subscribe and make sure you hit that bell notification so that you can get notifications of when we release new episodes on the podcast. You can also subscribe to the blog, where I have written not necessarily transcripts, but different articles around financial awareness that you would want to pick up. Just my thought leadership in that particular area of financial literacy, economic empowerment, and personal development. That is at djh-capital.com/blog. Or if you want to be old-fashioned, you just want to send me an email to info@djh-capital.com. I'll read those and I'll respond also. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave me a comment and tell me what impacted you the most. I love to hear from you and to know what interests you for future episodes. Remember, I am here to help you make the bigger and better decision with your life and money. Talk to you later. Bye for now, and have a happy and safe 4th of July.